Jill? Jill, do you remember if our Zoom thing is for 300 or what the number?
Okay, let's get started. So welcome everybody to this meeting of the Faculty Senate. You see the usual rules apply up there on the slide. A reminder again that the audio and the chat are posted, so everything is totally public. Okay, just a couple of quick announcements, Jill. Next slide. Jill? Oops.
Charlie, you're frozen.
Oh boy. Okay, but you can hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, next slide, Jill.
The slide is there for the next meeting.
Okay, I can't. I'll just talk from my phone. Okay, yeah, so just a quick note on some issues that relate to academic integrity. A bunch of us over the summer talked about some issues that surfaced during the spring semester, and we're working to make a couple of improvements to the code. Three different things. So one concerns Zoom meetings, whether or not the recording can replace the hearing witness. The second one concerns if a student is found guilty of an infraction, is taking the course SU, that doesn't give the instructor very many options. So we're going to look into the possibility of changing the student's grade option. These are all proposals to be discussed. This is just a heads up. And the third one is if you have a very, very large case, it's actually, it can be actually impossible for the instructor to manage every single primary hearing. And so what that means is that we're looking into a way that we're some of the work can be delegated in a very careful way with the consent of the chair. And next slide, Jill. So this has the current to-do list. These are just some things that I'm working on like right now, among other things. So one is we have to figure out how to schedule prelims, evening or online prelims during the upcoming term. We can't have collisions, so we need some guidance there. And I'll be working with the EPC and others to see if we can get some sensible rules out there. Second, as you know, during a normal semester, students love to shop courses. It's a great way of figuring out what you want to do. You get to meet the, or see the professor and so on. And that, of course, is problematic with the current setup. So, how can we, if at all possible, replicate that critical start of semester phenomena. And third, you may know that there's a large group of students that I think they number about 300 that form what are called the peer health ambassadors. They're going to have a really critical role to play, as do we. And as you've probably taken a look at some of the behavioral compact literature that's been sent your way. And I'm going to look into how we might coordinate with them here, learn what they're seeing and whether or not faculty can somehow play a role in that whole scene. Okay, so I'm going to actually, Jill, I'm going to hand it off to Pat Wynn. Pat, are you there? This is awkward because my screen is frozen. Nima?
I'm right here, Charlie. I don't think Pat's here yet.
Want to switch and I'll go first,
Yeah,
Charles?
why don't you start, Mike? Mike will give us an overview of sort of where we are. I've asked him to focus on like a couple of things, the testing scene and also enrollments. So take it away, Mike.
Sure. So Jill, could you go to the testing results slide? Let me just update faculty here. So thanks. So we're in the middle of our initial part of testing, which we're calling arrival testing. And that testing is being done, as many of you know, by nasopharyngeal swab. It's the most sensitive test, followed by PCR. And that's ongoing, and I'll give you results of that in a moment. Very good news so far in terms of prevalence of the entering population of students coming back to Ithaca and the faculty and staff that we've tested. We're also during this period of time testing for cause. So anybody that's symptomatic, either go, if it's a student, goes to Cornell Health and we'll get a test overnight, one day turnaround. And then, and faculty, either through their healthcare providers separately, if they're not picked up in the screen, if people are symptomatic, they would go to their healthcare providers. And then we're about to now pivot into our surveillance testing program, which is an ongoing surveillance testing program that has a cadence depending on really the interactions with students. So students are tested twice a week. Faculty can be tested twice a week if they're student facing. That includes also for faculty that are in residence, their families and their children and spouses. Graduate students can be twice a week, if they're student facing, and certainly if they're resident advisors, or they could be once a week. And we're also allowing people to opt out if they're not coming to campus, if they have no reason to come to campus. And then faculty that have less frequent interactions with students can be once every other week. And we're talking about how to, one of the things we want to do is make that convenient for faculty so that if you're not coming to campus on a regular basis, you don't have to come to campus all the way into campus to a testing site that's crowded. So we're looking into some drop-off options. You'll hear some more about that. So next slide, please, Jill. So this is a day old, but you'll see we have something between 0.1%, and actually the overall numbers are less than 0.1% now between undergraduates and graduate students, and then also for faculty, it's even lower. And so this is one person in 1,000. And yesterday we did another 1,300 or so tests, one positive. So we're seeing a consistent less than 0.1% prevalence in our student community, which is just terrific news. We had assumed that we would have on the order of 2% positive. So rather than one student in 1,000, 20 in 1,000 coming back for students from the non-quarantine states, and 4%, so 40 coming back from the quarantine states. All of that is much better than our predictions, which makes our modeling actually more effective in terms of the sort of safety margins that we have. Next slide, please, Jill. That's been done. I do want to point out it's been done by creating a new laboratory in the veterinary college. It has capability of testing 50,000 people a week. And that surveillance testing will be done by an anterior nares sample. So students and faculty and staff will come in, take a swab, swirl it around one nostril, the anterior part, the front part of that, then swirl it around a second nostril. It'll be put into a solution and it'll go off to the lab that's up at the veterinary college. New lab that's been stood up, so we're not really poaching on existing capacity in the area. Very efficient. And in the meantime, we're also, Jeff Pleiss from Molecular Biology is working on pooling at a greater level. That lab is pooling, which allows us to do 50,000, but we're looking at expanding that using the best kind of science to do that. There is a dashboard. I think everybody probably knows by now. The dashboard is up. It'll have a two-day delay as we get these results back. But everybody will be able to see the daily positives and the total number of tests, the weekly number, and then the total up until now. Let me just say one thing about testing, because with numbers, it is important to have a context. We are testing, all the surveillance testing will be asymptomatic individuals. The estimates are that as many as 80% of people that are infected with COVID-19 virus are asymptomatic. So if you're just testing symptomatic people, as we have been in Tompkins County heretofore, you're likely to get a very much lower number. The whole point of our surveillance testing is really to identify people that are asymptomatic before they can spread the disease and isolate them, get them out of circulation. And so by virtue of that, we will have more positives. I've said, and it's been reported, that one of the triggers to go to red, the shutdown, is a number of 250 positives. But that number is a number of asymptomatic individuals that are positive, much, much higher than you would predict if you were only only testing symptomatic people. So if you think about a 4-to-1 ratio, that's the equivalent of having, over the course of the week, something like 60 symptomatic individuals. Too many, and we're, and the point that I would make is, we have a meeting every day where we look at the data at the end of the day. Martha and I chair a meeting. We look at it with a head of Cornell Health, Ryan Lombardi, Gary Koretsky, Peter Frazier, who's done the modeling, Marty Stallone, who is the CEO of Cuga Health Systems, and then we have Tompkins County Health Department come once a week. So we're all looking at this, we're all monitoring this on a real-time basis, and then that's key to making sure that we stay in a position that we are now, and if we start to stray from that, we understand it and take some steps to correct it. I'll just say a couple words now about enrollment. You can stop the slides, Jill, if you'd like. Enrollment started today. My understanding, I talked to Lisa today, that is going well. You know, that's in a phased process where individuals, first juniors and seniors, enroll, and then freshmen and sophomores, and get 6 credits at a time, and then it cycles back again. That has been an enormous lift because it's required individuals in the registrar's office to change every course because they now had to have fields that they never had before, such as, is the course online? Is it face-to-face? And that has required all of this to be uploaded, all the thousands and thousands of courses to be uploaded to PeopleSoft. And it was an enormous lift, but Lisa and her team and John Burdick and the registrar's office really were able to do that and get it ready for enrollment today. That's one of the things that was the delay. And my understanding is that's going well. And Charlie's point about shopping is one that we've been talking about, and can we find a way in which we allow students to do the normal kind of trial and error for courses as they go through drop and add. Just say a couple more words about community. We have been working very closely with the community. Last night, Joel Molina and I spoke to the Ithaca School Board and talked about what we're doing and talked about how we might be able to help with the school system. We have been talking with the county and been helping in terms of some support for testing for the county. Those are conversations that Martha has had. And of course, we're interfacing with Cuga Health System and with the County Health Department in a very intimate way, in which we're all thinking about the data together, making changes in real time, and cooperating, which is really key. Finally, let me just say a couple words about some of the hiccups that have occurred. This is an enormous logistical lift for the university. It's something that hasn't been done before. It's the fact that we are in the position that we're in is the combined efforts of really hundreds of people that have been working flat out to get us to this point. That's not to say we haven't had some bumps in the road, some issues around communicating what we're doing timely enough, some misunderstandings, etc. One of these arose with resident advisors and GRAs. We've been working with the faculty and residents and the RAs and GRAs to try and talk about their concerns. I think those conversations are going well. We've been able to address concerns around the cadence or frequency of testing, about the availability of PPE and monitors in areas, and also begun a process of talking longer term about some issues around the RA and GRA jobs that were pre-COVID tension points and ones that we had, I know Ryan's group had been discussing and had a committee and some recommendations, but sort of got put to the back burner as we faced March and the COVID crisis. So those are all ongoing, but I would just say then finally two things. One is that we have not expected 100% compliance of anything as we to have a successful semester. We know that there is not going to be a perfect compliance, perfect execution. Our modeling, our system doesn't depend on that. We have what I call a nested group of safety barriers. First is entry testing, then this surveillance system. It's also mask wearing, it's also social distancing. It's changing our facilities, changing our filters, de-densifying our classrooms, it's our travel policy. It's all of this together that will make this successful. So far so good, but we are not complacent. We're looking at the data on a regular basis, and we will make changes if we need to make changes all the way to reversing course if it looks like this is not working. So then the final point is what will make it work? What will make it work is all of us. All of us, students particularly, making sure that we send the right message to our peers, but faculty and staff also modeling appropriate behavior and pointing out inappropriate behavior where it occurs in an appropriate way, and us working together as a community to do something that frankly very few universities have been able to pull off. And that would be the last point that I would make, which is I know that individuals are alarmed at what's happened at UNC, at Notre Dame and other institutions. I would point out that every institution is different with different plans. We have had a plan that required this kind of intensive surveillance to be able to be successful. Others have not done that. They've relied strictly on testing for cause, testing when people emerge as symptomatic. That means that you're not controlling that period of time when someone's infected, shedding virus, but has not yet developed symptoms. That is what's gotten a lot of places into trouble, as those have created super spreader incidents, and they've started to amplify and create community spread. It's not to say it can't happen here, but we're watching it very closely, and our whole testing program is predicated on finding those people early on. And that's how we've decided on our testing cadence. So with that, I'll stop and take any questions, or we'll go to Pat first if she's ready.
Yeah, let's have Pat give an overview of the residence hall scene, and then we can go to questions to both of you. So Pat, just give us a nice overview of what you're seeing in the dorms at this point.
Sure. So as of today, for days 1, 2, and 3, 2,803 students were checked into housing following their COVID-19 tests to serve their 24-hour quarantine, and they're either living in a single or in a hotel. Day 4, as of 2 p.m. today, 375 students were checked in from the 24-hour quarantine period from an area hotel. Projected arrivals for Thursday testing are 486, and projected arrivals for Saturday testing are 522. If you want to look at the next slide, Jill, if you could just show that picture. So this photo was taken right around lunchtime earlier today, and the picture's gone. There it is. And these are students who made the decision to have lunch together, but they definitely spaced themselves appropriately. And one of my dining folks was walking by and congratulated them on being so conscientious. And you can see the big smiles on their face. And I truly believe that this group represents the majority of Cornell students. So I just wanted you to be able to see that. We have already changed our plans for tomorrow's arrival testing in response to the severe weather advisory. So students who are coming in tomorrow, they'll actually be tested at the Ramen Room in Bartels, and then they will be shuttled or driven over to their quarantine hotel. That process, though very complicated, has actually gone pretty smoothly. And they really are 6 feet apart. It's just the way the photo was taken, it sort of foreshortened some of it. And it's been a really smooth process. We might have some stragglers. We might have some stragglers that are going to arrive on August 31st. But for the most part, we will be done with our major move-in starting by this Sunday. Those currently in 14-day quarantine will move into their regular assigned housing beginning on September the 1st. And between August 17th and August 23rd, we had tested about 5,000 students with four positives. It was about a 0.08 positivity rate. I'm not sure if anybody's talked about that yet. Students that are coming in states on the New York State Travel Advisory List have been told to begin their semester remotely until their state comes off that list. Then and only then will we invite them back to campus under the same strict testing and quarantine regimen. We are now in the process of retesting students who arrive on Sunday, August 23rd, and that will continue with the regular surveillance testing regimen over the next few weeks. We are using OpenTable to make reservations for dining in location dining and also for dining pickup. So this enables us to know in advance how many students will be arriving at one of our dining halls who want to pick up their meals to take out, and also enable us to know how many students are going to want to dine in together with the appropriate spacing. And what's interesting about that is OpenTable told us that it would probably take about 2 weeks, 3 weeks to get up to about 25% participation. But Cornell students being Cornell students, we're already up to 39% participation in 2 days. Let's see. The reporting tool for the Behavioral Compact and COVID-19 concerns is now live. This tool is for non-emergency recording of behaviors involving students, organizations, or employees who do not promote a healthy and safe community during the pandemic caused by COVID-19. They are working on a vanity URL, but I can share this link with you now. It's a big one, but we'll share. Go ahead, can you type that in?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. And we're also gonna give you the Behavioral Compact PDF and FAQ that are available for everyone to look at. So it is working. The Behavioral Compact monitors have been walking across campus regularly for the past few days, in addition to assisting us with move-in. And that's been actually very successful. We think that these students are really dedicated to this position and they want to make this work. The flu vaccine clinics are starting this week. All students are required to get the flu vaccination. And there are many, many virtual events for students to attend while they're in quarantine. And these events are being shared by the new student programs and campus activities. I will tell you that for the most part, the res halls have been very quiet. We've had one instance of a potential party that happened yesterday that it's being investigated. but that's one out of the, you know, 2,800 students that we've already moved in. So I think people are taking it seriously. I think students will start to monitor themselves very, very seriously. And we are, I think, in good shape. I don't know, you know, I don't know if you are all aware that we're putting students into hotels, but that's what we're doing for, we did it yesterday, we'll do it again tomorrow, and we'll do it again on Saturday, so that everyone has a single room with their own bathroom, and they can isolate, or I'm sorry, quarantine safely until their testing is cleared. The system now is that it's integrated with CMC, so students receive an email telling them that they are cleared, and these results have been coming in fairly quickly. If there is a problem, there's a team working on resolving it. And by a problem, I mean anything that any test results that are not finalized. They're calling them pending. If a student does test positive, that situation is turned over to Tompkins County Health Department, and they begin the process of placing that student in isolation. So that's everything I have, and I guess we're going to take questions now.
Okay, thanks a lot, Pat.
Sure.
So we'll do, you know, raise your hand. I see Wendy Wilcox.
Yes, so I posed the question. I saw Mike addressed it somewhat about the seat reservation system. I'm actually interested in the seat reservation system that's going to be managing quiet study seats or seats for students who will be taking online courses on campus. Can you speak to when that is going to be up and running?
Yeah, I don't, Wendy, sorry, we can get you the answer to that. I don't know when it's going to be up. I know they're planning on that. I assume that will launch September 2 when courses launch, but we can find that out.
Okay. That'd be great.
Richard.
I live in Forest Home. We have a Forest Home Improvement Association. And three days ago, we received a message from Gary Stewart with the Cornell Compact Compliance Team. And he told us that there would be a protocol for reporting violations of the student compact, in which members of the neighbors, my neighbors in the Forest Home, could report to Cornell a description of the conduct that was observed that violated the compact, the address and the names, if they were known, of those who violated the compact, and they could take pictures of the violation, but that wasn't necessary. Now, in that protocol, they said that this would go live for the rest of for Cornell community on September 2nd. So this, I take it, is just a preview. But could you elaborate on this?
Sure, Richard.
Protocol, yeah. Process, whatever you want to call it.
Sure. As an ex-Forest Home resident, as you know, I get those messages as well. So this refers to what has been requested of us, which is to have an anonymous site where individuals in the community can report things like non-face mask wearing, parties, etc. And that is a website. It was originally proposed to be up by September 2. I think I've heard that it is now up. Pat, do you know that?
Yeah, that's the URL of that's the information I just put on the chat. So it is now live.
It is now live.
Yes.
So anyone can report an incident, and then it can be followed up. And particularly if there are situations like parties at a residence or something, the idea is we can follow that up and find, we will know who is the, who holds the lease and hold those individuals responsible.
Okay. I don't see any more hands. Does anyone like to, there's some really good dialogue on the chat. Does anyone like to?
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't keep up with all of the questions here.
Let's see.
I see Risa has her hand up. Risa?
Yeah, thank you. So I have some questions that are related, but not, you know, directly coming out of this specific information. And the first one has to do with, there seems to be some confusion about who has a choice to be on campus and who doesn't. You know, some of that has to do with who has the choice to be here to teach. And it'd be really good to have some clarifications on whether that covers, you know, all instructors of record. Does it cover teaching assistants? So there's that group, you know, teachers, and then there's people doing teaching and research assistants as well. And then there's, you know, staff, which covers, of course, many, many different kinds of people, including people in the libraries, as well as, you know, staff in other areas. Clarify that?
So I'm not sure. So for individuals who are teaching in person, they obviously have the ability to come to campus and teach. You know, the general guidelines pertain, which is if you can work at home and you can do that productively, you should. That allows us to densify the campus and it contributes to everybody's safety. If you need to be on campus, so for example, teaching, you're certainly qualified. You fill out the daily attestation and you are permitted to come to campus. In terms of using offices, I think your question really goes to those individuals that are not necessarily teaching or have a direct responsibility, but want to use their offices or their labs or their studios for something else, for their own scholarly work or their own ability to work. Those we've placed within the colleges for faculty to request their ability to occupy their offices in the context of an overall plan for that building or that department, so that we are compliant with the guidelines of the state around total density of buildings. And so the only requirement there is to be part of your own department's plan for who will be in and when they will be in, so that they're not overlapping and we don't get density that's beyond that those New York State guidelines.
Yeah, I mean, my question was sort of the flip side of that, which is, you know, what is the level of choice that individuals have who do not want to be on campus? I mean, I think it's quite clear that tenure track and tenured faculty have the choice to teach online. I think there's some confusion about how extensive is that choice to be online in terms of people who are RTE faculty, as well as TAs, as well as, you know, other staff who say, well, I don't want to be here. And so what is the level of freedom of choice that exists in those different categories to not be here?
Yeah, I think we've been pretty clear around all faculty, that is RTE faculty, tenure track faculty, having the option to teach online if that is their choice. We've also been pretty clear that For graduate student assistants, research teaching assistants, that we try and accommodate those individuals through this this process of asking for exclusion if you're concerned about showing up. So there, the idea is that you would go through a process where you would ask to be relieved from that responsibility. And that's a well-defined process. We've talked about it a number of times. Virtually every town hall I've talked about that, Risa. So I'm not sure why there would be confusion.
Okay, I didn't realize you weren't done.
On the staff side, mm-hmm. So the real issue is whether individuals as part of their work, custodians, others, need to be on campus to complete their work. And that's something that's determined within their own units in terms of when they come in, how they come in, whether they can work from home, whether they can be, their job is just as productive from home. And again, in those cases where we've emphasized as much as possible that if there's no need to be on campus, one shouldn't be on campus. Let me finally say one other thing, which is that if we do this correctly, we are, and I certainly understand the concern and the fear of individuals, but what we've done through de-densifying the campus and requiring mask wearing and requiring social distancing is drive the risk of those interactions down as close to zero as possible. Certainly they're not zero, but as you know, if you go shopping, if you go food shopping, et cetera, everybody's wearing a mask, you're interacting in a way that's safe. There's very, very, the science tells us there's very, very little risk of transmission of virus.
Okay. I don't see any more hands. I was offline for a bit, Mike, and I'm not sure if you covered this, so ignore my suggestion here, but could you go through the kinds of things that will perhaps trigger a shutdown? So I know there you mentioned like 250 cases, things about supplies, just a little bit about those thresholds and how you think about them.
Thanks. So really there are four areas that we want to make sure that we can assure ourselves that we have control over. One is the number of cases, as I mentioned. And we picked that number of cases. The real critical parameter here is R naught, what the spread is, what the exponential spread is. I'm infected, how many people I spread to. That's a bit of a nuanced issue and one that can be very local or it can be average and is not something that the public can really grasp as much. So we looked at the modeling. Peter Frazier developed this idea that if we get beyond 250, we're in a range where we're starting to see community spread and we have to do something dramatic to slow that. So one is controlling the amount of cases, controlling obviously the infection in our Cornell community and in our local community. A second is our local health capacity. And here we collaborated with CUGA Health Services to say, how do we know when we're beyond our sort of safety limit on one is ICU beds, two is ventilators, and three is patients under care. So if we can't provide the physician capacity to treat patients. And so there, that's a second area where we've now quantified that. Any one of these triggers, it will themselves trigger a discussion of what, where we are. A third is our quarantine and isolation space. As Pat mentioned, what is critical here is that as we identify individuals, we can isolate them and have a place to take them out of the potential of infecting others. And so we look at our quarantine and isolation capacity constantly to make sure that we have enough, we have the right safety capacity. And then lastly is our testing, because so much depends on testing, whether we have enough reagents, we have a 1 month supply always at hand, that sort of thing to make sure that we have the ability to continue our testing process. So all four of those in sum allow us to, any one of those will trigger a discussion of shutdown, but even if none of them trigger it, none of them go to that level, we meet every day. And if they're all trending up and they're all rising, we might shut down without any of them triggering that. We also might, if one of them triggers it, if for example, we don't have reagents, but we know we're getting a supply in the next couple of weeks, it might not trigger an automatic shutdown. So it's important for all of these to be taken in context and considered, but those are the four things we're fundamentally looking at in terms of providing a safe environment for the community.
Okay.
Mark Wysocki and Wendy Wilcox both have their hand up.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Mark?
Michael, I apologize if you had addressed this somehow, either verbally or written, but I submitted a question about what happens if a faculty member or staff tests positive. Then is it up to us to find a location to quarantine, or will Cornell help us in that?
Yeah, for individuals that are living privately with their own residents, the first option is for you to find a place to quarantine, or if you test positive, to isolate. That is something that's done with the county in communication with the county. So the county determines what what's necessary in terms of that quarantining. Can you be in a room if you're in a single family household, can you be in an area by yourself, a bathroom by yourself, that sort of thing. Certainly we would have a discussion if there are situations that arise. And that's something that we're working with the county on. It also comes up with students in College Town if they're living in a group setting, that sort of thing.
Okay, thank you.
Wendy.
I want to follow up on the seating question, and then I actually want to follow a little bit up on Risa's question about the libraries, because the libraries are opening, and we're very dependent on the seat reservation system for managing contact tracing and presumably safety and de-densification, because there aren't mechanisms in place to meet those targets of reduced density otherwise. And then the other question, so I do want to talk a little bit more about what happens if that system is not available or ready by the start of the semester. And then my second question is, we're getting a lot of requests from faculty, especially who want access to the libraries. They want to use their studies, whatnot. And my question is we don't have an understanding if a faculty member is approved to be on campus. So how should we be handling those things?
Well, so let me take your second question first. A faculty member will not be able to come to campus unless they go through the daily attestation, as we all do. I did it this morning, and I'm permitted to come to campus. So you have to go through that attestation and be permitted, and you know, that's a symptomatic question, et cetera. So if those individuals are approved through that process and system, and they meet the issues that are specific for the library in terms of operations of the library and de-densifying the library, I don't think there's really an issue, Wendy, for the library. Everybody has to be part of the surveillance system, or you will not be able to come to campus. You do not get access to campus, so everybody has to be surveilled. That lowers the likelihood that any individual will go into the library and be infected. And then the fact that we have to have distancing, we have to have mask wearing, again, lowers this risk for library personnel or others in the library to a level that is, again, not zero, but pretty darn close.
Can I just ask one question on that? Because I guess maybe I'm operating, I'm a little confused, because my understanding is not everyone is legitimately approved to be on campus. So I thought that because we were writing reactivation plans, there were only some people who were approved to be on campus. Is that not the case?
Well, I think there are two different things. One is approved to occupy a space. And you know, your laboratory, your office, your area, and how that is occupied. But if you go through the daily attestation, anyone can come on to campus. We don't have my answer to that would be anyone could be approved to use the library if they are part of that daily attestation. They are up to date on the surveillance testing system. They answer that questionnaire about symptoms and contacts, et cetera. Yes, then they're available to come to the library or use other university facilities subject to the rules of those facilities. Does that make sense? Okay.
That does make sense. And then now the first question.
Remind me of the first
question. It's about the seat reservations.
Oh, yes. My full assumption is that we will have that open. I can get back to Charlie on when the timing is for that to be open, but I know there's a lot of planning on that. I just don't know when they're pulling the trigger.
Okay, very good. Well, I'd like to thank Mike and Pat for coming in and answering questions. We're down to the last few days now before classes start, and I'm sure they're gonna be last minute announcements and things like that. So again, thanks an awful lot. And now we'll move on to the the second half of today's discussion. Okay. Yeah, just a reminder, you all know that slides are online and you can certainly access them. Okay, so the second half of today's meeting is concerned with the anti-racism initiative. Next slide, Jill. So at the previous meeting, we stepped through these. Nima and I just sort of gave a heads up. We had a fair amount of discussion about the center idea. These were the 5 points that the president identified for us to act on, okay? And this is gonna be a joint venture with students all along the way from start to finish. So we have 4 guests. Next slide, please, Jill. These are students who are leaders in the Do Better Cornell movement. And I've had some excellent discussions with them already, and they're going to share with us their view of things and then open it up to questions. So I'd like to hand off to Amber. Amber, you're in the rooms.
Yes, thank you, Professor Van Loan. I'm right here.
Great, okay. So again, just tell Jill when you want the next slide.
Okay, next slide is good. So we are Do Better Cornell. Can you click the next slide? Thank you. And so just for context, we are a collective of students and alumni who released demands to the university on June 12th, 2020. And really we came about these demands. There are 2 separate petitions and really they followed the murder of George Floyd and also inappropriate actions from Cornell community members that we felt needed to be addressed, and we didn't feel like the response from the university particularly understood nor enacted upon for the betterment of Black students, particularly on campus. And so we released a variety of demands. These demands included actions surrounding police, financial security of students, as well as larger institutional changes to the university. And we also want to recognize the people who came before us. So these demands were built upon from BSU in 2015 and 2017, as well as most recently Julia Feliz in 2019. And so there are 2 petitions, which hopefully when you all have the chance to look back afterwards that you can access them and really dive deep into them. But today we're going to be discussing particularly 3 demands that we put forward that we feel the Faculty Senate can help us address. Next slide, please.
So we're gonna talk about 3, I'm Colin, by the way. We're gonna talk about 3 of sort of the demands that were in those petitions that concern the Faculty Senate. So these are things that the Faculty Senate could have a particular impact in that were part of those topics displayed beforehand or things that sort of fall in the jurisdiction of what is done here. So the first of those is sort of the universal diversity, equity, and inclusion learning that we're hoping to roll out both for students, so maybe in the form of coursework, and for faculty as sort of a more formal programming. The second, we'll talk about student involvement in faculty appointments. So in the search committee and the hiring process, how we could get a more diverse set of opinions there. And finally, talking about the creation of this anti-racism institute. So a more centralized place with university backing that will really, do a better job at educating community and spreading awareness of things like white supremacy and politicized education. Next slide, please. So the first of those points, kind of the first half of the universal DEI learning is focusing on students. And there are existing models both at Cornell and at a lot of our peer institutions that can kind of inform how we go about making this education. So for example, you know, CALS has a requirement for completing a course satisfying what the university calls its human diversity requirement. Wellesley has a universal one-unit requirement, and UPIT recently rolled out this anti-Black racism course that's geared towards informing freshmen, incoming students, and is required as part of their education. So it's important that Cornell sort of focus on this now and joins the forefront of what a lot of these peer institutions are doing, and is a really important topic for educating students that are incoming to this university. And it's a great first step, examining diversity from this broad perspective that sort of sets a universal requirement across all departments, across all schools at Cornell. But you know, past that, it's important we dig a little deeper to create a more enduring culture of anti-racism that is more specific to the education that each student in the various departments is receiving. I'll hand it over now to Uche. Next slide, please.
Okay, hi all, I'm Uche, it's a reintroduction. But the next demand is, universal diversity, equity, and inclusion learning for faculty. So this demand stems from the fact that students from marginalized backgrounds want to know or need to know that there's a commitment from faculty to always be informed on, you know, their personal biases, struggles that students from different backgrounds face on a daily basis, and to always ensure that courses, coursework, and faculty are as accessible and as approachable as possible, and that there's a particular sensitivity to the issues that students from marginalized backgrounds face. Things such as, you know, being cognizant of the language and mannerisms that are used inside and outside of the classroom in all different types of contexts, and also ensuring that, you know, we're not pushing students to relive or recount traumas or hardships that they constantly face in order to receive the resources that they need. So there, there's a link that's attached to this slide. But there are a lot of resources for faculty to have these different types of conversations surrounding DEI work. But we also recognize the fact that these resources won't have the intended impact, a guaranteed impact, if there isn't ongoing education and conversation being led by faculty. So some of the questions that we have been asking and we're pondering and we're looking to kind of build this learning for faculty around is, you know, these workshops, putting together workshops, are they being utilized and are they reaching their intended audience? Are they reaching the target audience? How is Cornell currently upholding DEI standards across all faculty? And looking for the creation of a permanent requirement for tenure track faculty to demonstrate meaningful commitment and contribution to DEI work at Cornell. Next slide. another demand is student involvement in faculty appointments. So students want to have the ability to be able to have a say in who is coming to Cornell to teach them, to be a part of this community. Students want to know that Cornell is going to introduce a mechanism to hold departments accountable for meeting diversity and inclusion standards. So we currently understand that this process right now is decentralized by departments, and it currently lacks universal and enforceable search committee standards and expectations. So one of the things that we're looking for is with these search committees and with putting students on them, we want to make sure that we're having students from different backgrounds, marginalized communities that can provide different sets of perspectives, unique perspectives for potential hires. One of the things that I think back to is with SDDI or the Student Diversity SDDI, I'm forgetting the entire name of it, but when they were doing their new hires or doing the interviews for their potential hires, they had me and a couple other students sit on a small committee where we interviewed the potential hire, we interacted with them, we kind of, sat through and tried to get a pulse and understanding of, how they would integrate with the student community here at Cornell and, what their views and perspectives were on, different topics, issues, things of that nature. So, and I guess I'll hand it off to Amina.
Hi, next. Next slide. Hi, I'm Amina. So the final demand that we want to talk about is the creation of an anti-racism institute. You may be familiar with this, as President Pollack had mentioned this in her July 15 message, but we think it's important to have a university-backed institute that will centralize the anti-racism efforts and keep them institutionalized so that we can build upon them and make sure that students of future generations, faculty, and staff are working collaboratively to build an anti-racist university. There are ongoing initiatives within the Cornell community that are doing certain things like that between the different academic departments that President Pollack has mentioned, as well as Engage Cornell, Rural Humanities, Intergroup Dialogue Project, Skills for Success, and the Center for the Study of Inequality. We think this institute is important. It is not the first of its kind. Should it be developed at Cornell, there already are existing institutes at American University, Boston University, and Claremont Graduate University. However, we think that Cornell really has a special opportunity to be the first member of the Ivy League to create an anti-racism institute and build this scholarship and research center, as well as, you know, ongoing education effort for generations to come. Next slide, please. So yes, that's the end of us talking about the demands we think would involve the Faculty Senate. We really appreciate any of your questions, comments, concerns, or participation as we make this happen. If anyone's interested in being added to our monthly faculty updates, I'm the one who sends out those emails. You can email us at info@dobettercornell.com or go to our website and, you know, ask any questions through that mechanism. But yes, we'll take any questions that you have right now.
Okay, thank you. Avery has his hand up. Avery August.
Thank you, Charlie. I just wanted to turn on my camera here. Thank you for this presentation. Just a question generally for the students' view on the university's efforts. Do you have a sense of how much the students, particularly the undergraduate students, are aware of what the institution does with regards to hiring and promotions, et cetera?
I'll go ahead and take this first question. I think we're mostly very lost, unless there is some sort of email that is sent out, which I know some departments do, which is like, you know, we're down to our final two people for, we're hiring this new person. Come in, see how they present, give us your feedback. But unless there is an outreach from departments to students to have student feedback, I truly feel like most students are pretty blind towards the hiring process for new faculty members.
Just wanted to add here, so just for everyone's information, I'm the Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, and just to provide some context, we do quite a bit on accountability structures for hiring, the search process. I think, I'm not sure what your links link to, but if you look at faculty development at Cornell, you'll see a large number of resources that we have for department chairs, for applicants, and for search committees, including the contribution to diversity statement, which we included for faculty searches starting last year. I think Yael Levitate, who's the Associate Vice Provost and Director of that office, can also provide a lot more information on our processes along those lines. So it would be great if we could provide you more information on what we do and also what we can improve with regards to including much more inputs into these processes.
Yeah, we actually looked at the website and we thought it was fantastic. And there's a link to the website in our presentation. What we found was that there was no explicit recommendation for undergraduate students to be involved within the search process. We saw that this was some for graduate students and just wanted to highlight the fact that undergraduates also have something to contribute to the process.
Thank you.
David Delchamps. Yeah, you're muted, Dave.
Kind of answer my question a little bit there, because I was going to say that in the College of Engineering, this is not decentralized by departments, the diversity and inclusion stuff in the hiring. It's a college level thing. There's a something called the Strategic Oversight Committee. And when you guys said that there were, it was decentralized among the departments, I was thinking, oh my God, is the Arts College that way or is Cal's that way? But I think Avery, you may make me think that there's something similar in other colleges to our Strategic Oversight Committee for diversity, inclusion and hiring.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, we have a check-in process in each stage. All of the colleges have that, such that we use a very similar mechanism for, or other colleges should be using a very similar mechanism to the College of Engineering.
Okay, and one other thing I want to mention is that I saw that you recommend that tenure-track faculty pursue some kind of education in this stuff. Why just them? I mean, there's a lot of other faculty members. I think every faculty member could profit from that, to tell you the truth, not just tenure track.
You're referring to the RTE faculty, the senior lecturers, lecturers.
Yeah. RTE and you know, even for example, I know that TAs have a lot of training, but they could also profit from something like this as well, I think. But anyway.
Very good. Risa and then Yale. Risa.
Yeah, thanks. And thank you to the Do Better Cornell Committee and the students for being here. I think that these are excellent ideas. I wanted to just touch on a couple of things. One is, since we've been talking about the search committee, certainly I support that. And, you know, there are a lot of departments that do that. But I think that the point that's being made is that this needs to be uniform. I mean, committees are different from one department or one college to the next, but there can be a uniform policy, or at least a university-wide policy, I think, to have student participation on search committees. I think it's an excellent idea and really something that should be done and is being done. I'd also, you know, there have been other people talking about promotions committees. I think that student participation on promotions committees are really important. And also to look at the issue of retention. So there's a hiring question, but then there's also the question of how do we retain diversity on our faculty? And that's something where I think that all of us need to do a lot more work, and including the students in that process is important, as well as on curriculum committees. The other kind of search committee I would urge the students to consider including in your agenda has to do with administrators, whether it's at the college level for deans or administrators in the central administration. A lot of times faculty are not included in a full way on dean and administrator searches. And so it seems to me that this is an area where faculty and students would have in common a desire to have greater participation, and also to press for open searches, because openness is a way to promote the kinds of ideas about diversity. I have other ideas, but I know probably other people have things to say as well. And I don't know if the students have any thoughts about what I just said.
I totally agree with everybody that's been mentioning that, you, including also like RTE faculty and staff, as well as like TAs. I think the reason why we mentioned, or one of the main reasons why we mentioned specifically tenure track faculty, is just because of the incident that had happened, I think back in June, with the comment made by one of the professors here, Professor Dave Colton, for being specific. And I think a lot of students were very not happy with the fact that, like, you know, he was able to make such comments, I guess, on like his social media, like personal pages, and they felt like he wasn't really being held accountable. And I think the fact that, you know, tenured faculty, like, you know, essentially, like, you know, you can't leave, like, or not that you can't leave, but you know, it's basically like you're tied together with the school for life. I think a lot of students really just want to make sure that with any more tenure track faculty coming in, that there's a very, you know, apparent and strong commitment towards, you know, anti-racist work and making sure that they're being as approachable and accessible as possible to all students.
Thank you. Yale.
Hi. For the students who might know me, I work with Avery. I'm the Associate Vice Provost for Faculty Development and Diversity, and I'm answering, I think, questions around the RTEs. The RTEs are under our office's purview, so they have, for example, the new faculty orientation, which just concluded last year, included three out of the four sessions were on teaching in a diverse classroom, including an IDP session. We opened with an IDP session just like undergrads do. Then we did one generally on teaching in a diverse classroom, and a third one was on specific scenarios. And we had more engagement than we ever had. So this included tenured, because some people come in here tenured, and RTEs. Over the summer, about 200 faculty, deans, chairs, DGSs also took the IDP program separate from that. I know you had a question about the search committee training, you know, who takes it. I would say we've been doing it for about a decade now. I would say we have 1,700 faculty. I would probably say about 1,200 have taken it. Some of them left, some of them are new. But what we've seen with the accountability structure is that the colleges now require those faculty. If you're on a search committee, so we get a question, you know, when is it? Who's been there? I get questioned, who went to that? So there is a mechanism for at least educating what actually happens in the rooms. I'm not in 90 departments in multiple searches, but the colleges have been taking it quite seriously. Even though it's decentralized, they have been requiring it. And if someone can't come, they invite us often to a department meeting so that we do it at the department.
Thank you. Sophia. Sophia, you had your hand up. Maybe you took it.
I'm here.
Great. You have the floor.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much for coming here and presenting to us and for all your work on campus. So I wanted to ask about the required anti-racist course or multicultural course. I know that like the Cal State system in California has made a requirement for an ethnic studies course. And so I'm wondering, like from your perspectives, you know, from your peers, are students taking our courses? And I'm sorry, I didn't introduce myself. I'm in the Department of Anthropology and in the Latinx studies program. And sometimes, you know, our courses don't fill up. I'm just wondering how you feel about, possibly making requirements some of our courses in Africana studies and Latinx studies and American Indian and Indigenous studies, Asian American studies. If you feel like there's an interest among your peers for our courses.
I mean, I've taken classes in like the Africana Studies department. I know Amber has, we've even taken a class together. And I do think those classes are very important. You learn a lot in many different ways, especially a lot of education that may not have previously been given to students prior to when they came to Cornell. Another idea that we've thought about is, I think it would be a good idea maybe having people taking classes in those departments, but also for a like diversity requirement, tailoring it to specific colleges so that it's relevant to whatever fields or departments that people are going in. So like if someone's in engineering talking about, you know, ways in which engineering can have these biases and stuff like that, or, you know, in biology and stuff like that. So I think that can also help increase the engagement and student participation and interest in these diversity courses and make it relevant. So Cornell is producing student leaders who aren't just trained in one specific area, but are also, you know, well-rounded humans who aren't reproducing biases and reproducing racism within this world.
I definitely want to add in and just echo Amina's point, because I have a lot of peers who, you know, are taking very engineering focused curriculums who don't necessarily have the interest in taking courses that are housed under different colleges in very different programs, even if there's interest in sort of the basis of the concept of diversity. And I've seen much more interest when those classes find a sort of intersectionality between diversity studies and more, you know, technically focused programs. So definitely I think the interest is sort of predicated on that intersectionality and finding the mix. And also just to address some of the comments that have been made in the chat, which I saw Amber sort of responded to, but we definitely recognize that a lot of the departments do have involvement from undergrads at, you know, various levels of faculty, like promotion, hiring, and things like that. But we are interested in seeing it backed at the university level and standardized to make sure that, you know, even if there are departments that do have that sort of involvement, it's required across all departments and visible, I think, is important too, because there are a lot of students who might just not be able to see that at face value and would definitely be more appreciative and involved if they were made aware.
Thanks, Colin. Mark Lewis.
Thanks, Charlie, for the time, and thanks to the students for the great presentation. I have a couple of questions and maybe a point or two. So my first point is, it would seem to me that if a student comes here with enough credits in engineering, they would not be required, and they can sort of get out of the liberal studies requirements, they would be able to get out of the required course. So it would seem like we have to have the required course above and beyond, or in addition to whatever they can take APs to get out of. So that's an important piece in my mind. Second thing, we talked about undergraduate students being involved in the tenure process. In engineering, we do have undergraduate students. We ask undergraduate students for letters, but my concern here is, if I have two African-American students in my class, and those two students have experienced some bias issue, what are the odds that I'm going to actually kick those two students to write a letter for the faculty member? So an issue may be there that we're missing because we have a system that doesn't really recognize the issue of race in the whole process. So the third thing I want to mention is I appreciate everything the students have written here and spent the time to think it through, but it just seems to me that every time a race issue comes on campus, we react with education. And what happens to the person who's here for 20 years from now, who's already tenured today, who's continues to do racially insensitive remarks, et cetera, et cetera? Is there a punishment mechanism in place? And I'm talking about particularly about race. I'm not talking about just bias, race. And I'm really most interested, obviously, because I'm African-American, and what happens with the Black students. So I wonder about that. That was missing in the presentation, but it seems like an important piece that I would like to see added if it's at all possible. And then lastly, I would ask the question of the broader question of accountability. So if a person has done continued racist acts on campus, what is the senior administration going to do in terms of accountability to the people that have enabled that person to continue doing those things? And that seems to be another piece that I just wonder about, because I keep on hearing every so often, 3 or 4 years happens, goes by, and something racist happens on campus. And then we have a long list of things that we're going to do to react, which basically means educate. And I would like to see some accountability and some punishment. So those are my things. I don't know if there's any questions in there. Sorry.
I think to just touch on the first point that you had made, one way that we had imagined this requirement is it's something that someone would engage in with a course that's semester long, and then it would be similar to the way the freshman writing seminar operates, where there'd be like a diversity of them. It would have to be done, so that could touch on the point where it's different than liberal studies. And then like ideally when they come to Cornell, but could be done sometime throughout Cornell. So that's like one way we had imagined it. But we do think that it's important that there are consequences and there is accountability. Like that's why a lot of these demands were birthed out of the frustration with the university's response to Professor Collins' comments and the racially insensitive remarks that he's making. And that is something we do actually want to see as well, as greater accountability. And while education is a big important part, and we think institutionalizing things like the Anti-Racism Institute, we hope that can make change. We do think there also does need to be consequences.
Thank you.
Tamara. Okay. And Tamara, then Nima, raise your hand. But Tamara, then we'll get to Nima. Tamara? Tamara. OK,
I'm not sure if you're talking about me. I didn't raise my hand, so I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, I saw your hand up. Okay. Nima.
Actually, I just wanted to follow up with you, Mark. So when you speak about accountability and redress, what are you thinking about? I mean, can you give us like some concrete examples? Do you have something to share? That would be interesting to hear, I think.
Sure. So some people on the call may not know this, but Avery and Yael, those are the two speakers earlier, run a Faculty of Color luncheon series. And so we meet regularly. Even during the pandemic, we've been meeting over lunchtime. And invariably, I hear stories, and I'm really talking about faculty, but my guess is students experience a similar kind of thing. Invariably, I hear stories about someone experiencing some bias issue. And they don't raise to the level of wanting to file a bias report, but they stick with them. And these faculty members are really struck by this. And then lots of studies at Cornell have shown that faculty of color get tenure and leave, or leave right before tenure. And this is probably because they had a bad experience in their departments or in their college, or maybe even around Ithaca, and they decided it's time to go. And the university knows that we've been founded on several big issues. One of them is any person, any study. Another one, Eddie White says that if you accept these students or these faculty here, and they aren't welcome, well, then we're going to take care of them, even if the white majority faculty decide to leave. So that tells me that people have to step in, get in line, and not continue to perpetuate these kinds of things. That's the punishment question. I'm fully aware that there's lots of bias reporting options, and I'm fully aware that the dean of faculty investigates these things, and the provost has the ability to issue punishment. But those things are not addressed explicitly. What happens when a faculty member mistreats a particular student or a particular colleague in a situation? What is the university going to do? That's the question. I just don't see it in any of the conversations.
Good point.
Thank you.
Joni.
Thanks. Thank you for the Do Better Cornell. Thank you for coming. I have this is relating to what others have said about required education. I think anti-racism it's about, you know, the goal is real freedom, and there's something about being required to take something. Say with freshman writing, you know. So I'm in the English department. I teach writing. I teach poetry, and writing. People don't go into a freshman writing class feeling excited about this. It feels like an onerous obligation, and that can make the process of teaching the class more difficult. Many faculty who teach, freshman writing are paid less than other faculty. They're they don't have tenure. Cornell is better with that than many places, but still, that's the tendencies that the things we force people to do are valued less than the things people choose to do themselves. So there's so much fascinating, wonderful, exciting, necessary stuff to learn. I don't know if required courses are the way are the way to approach it. Thanks. I wanted to put that out there. Oh, and I wish that there were other, ways of encouraging people to step up for anti-racism courses, ways of encouraging the community to dedicate ourselves to how important this is. I really see it in line with forcing with a required course. Thanks.
I can go ahead and try to reconcile some of the points that you brought up that I think are very valid. One, I don't think that this required course around anti-racism is a particularly new idea. I'm in the College of Arts and Sciences. We have to take, you know, a variety of distribution requirements. We brought up the human diversity requirement in CALS that is already in place. And so I agree with you that sometimes, you know, when you force a student to do something, they'll do it, you know, with their heels dragging in the ground. However, I do want to bring attention to the chat and how some other folks have thought about this a little bit more creatively. And so making courses that have an anti-racism lens, but still focus on what students would naturally be inclined to take a course in, you know. And so I think having some of that involvement will maybe help to come over the barrier that people might face with taking a required course. But I honestly do think I've talked to a lot of my peers about this, and they really feel like a course is needed, especially for some people who, you know, their majors don't really talk about race at all, or, you know, they don't get that in their standard curriculum. And so to graduate from Cornell without having that experience of really having to think about something from a different perspective, from an anti-racism lens, and apply that to other situations, I feel is really crucial for any Cornell graduate.
You want to say something?
Yeah, and I just kind of wanted to echo off of Amber's point. I think I do agree in like most of the things that, you know, the university requires or what your major may require, you know, to complete or to get your degree. Like I understand for, you know, a lot of students may not be things that they want to do, but I think, you know, the bigger issue at hand is, you know, what Amber was saying, like, you know, this has been something that has been asked for years, or students have been demanding for years. And, you know, I just think about the fact that, I just think about the fact that, you know, there are some students who
naturally, you know, the White House that, you know, didn't keep
on to mute their microphone.
Obviously just does it, no one, you know, stands in his way, right? And I think that's partly his appeal. If you ask
me. But
what occurred to me, to the people are saying, yeah, it may be unconventional. Yeah, he may be pushing.
Okay, please mute your. We're getting close to end. I just want to see if we can get in as many hands as possible. So, Risa, I'm just going to skip over you for the time being, and we'll get people who haven't spoken yet. So, Chiara, then Bruce, then Harold. Chiara?
Yes, thank you. I would like, first of all, to thank the students from Do Better Cornell for voicing their concerns. And I think I would like to commend you for doing this. And I would also like to commend Amber for answering the previous comments so very kindly and constructively. I do think that a student who comes to Cornell, and I speak as a non-American, as someone who came to the US for this job at Cornell, and I think that is crucial to understand race. We can't, you know, I am uncomfortable about it. I grew up in a very different context. I'm learning. And I think the students, you guys and so many students at Cornell are very mature, but I'm not sure that everybody really knows what they need. So a little compulsion sometimes is necessary. I would also like to add that part of the problem, and I'm in arts and sciences, I don't think that explaining diversity is enough. I don't think that, and I teach in Asian studies, I teach Islam, and I don't think that it's enough to tell students, oh, you know, there are Muslims out there, or, you know, there might be Muslims in the classroom. We are diverse. I think that we need to provide students real skills to understand and be critical and understand how these identities interact with equality or disequality. And I think that these should be really your demands. It's not about just multicultural education. It's about getting well beyond that. And the last point that I wanted to make is about the fact that there is an issue with ghettoizing ethnic studies or racial studies. And I think that if Cornell wants to be ahead, I don't want to even say ahead of the curve at this point, but, you know, if we want to do something really good for our student body, would be to have more conversations about diversity in a critical way and about race across the curriculum. It's not about, I mean, yes, it is about first getting students to take a diversity requirement as a critical diversity, but it's also about infusing these principles across the curricula, across colleges. This is a lot to ask, but maybe it's a goal that could be put out there for departments and for the university institutionally. I hope that you guys that do better are getting good support and you're finding allies across faculty. I want to commend you again, and I would love to work more with you or with other students who are interested in doing this thing. So thank you for bringing it to our attention.
Yeah, and just very quickly, I just wanted to just echo both Amber and I'm sorry if I'm saying this wrong, Dr. Chiara Formici's points. It's just with making this a requirement, I can understand how students may not want to take it, but I think the fact of the matter is students need to take it. Me personally, I've been in office hours or I've been in situations where a student or a faculty member has said something that was offensive or racist, and they just did not know. And when they were called out on it, they just simply didn't know. They didn't know that there was what they said was a problem. They didn't know that saying certain words or saying things in different contexts, came across as offensive. And, I understand for some students, they may take this course that ends up being required and, kind of drag their feet through it. But I think that some kind of exposure is better than none.
Thank you. Bruce.
Thanks. So like everyone else, I want to, commend the students from Do Better Cornell and their colleagues for forcing us to move on this. And for today's presentation, I think one of the key issues that is central to their goal, to the goal that they presented about creating standardization across the university, and something that's going to force us to institutional change, and that's going to be the hard part. And what's being asked for is hard in a lot of ways, and we have to accept that. And one of the key things is that especially at the curriculum level, that we have traditionally believed that every college should control its own curriculum. And the idea that there might be some single requirement that beyond the swimming test that covers the whole university, that's a really hard institutional change. I think we need to make it. I think we have, I think this is one of the changes that we need to confront, but it's something that all of us as senators need to bring back to our departments and to our colleges, that the kinds of changes that are being asked for that are necessary require hard institutional change. And that might be one of the things that we need to think about giving up, is the total independence of individual colleges. Maybe issues where we need to have university-wide requirements.
Thanks, Bruce. Harold.
Yes, Harold Hodes in philosophy. Well, there are many kinds of courses with different kinds of content that can have anti-racist force, at least within the College of Arts and Sciences, which has a distribution requirement on social difference. I would think that there could be a wide variety of courses which would fall under that umbrella and would have anti-racist force. One thing that has struck me just talking to undergraduates, both in class and outside of class, is how ignorant many people are about the history of injustice. Not just the history of racial injustice, but the broad history of injustice. And I would think that it would be particularly important to have a good number of courses available under some umbrella which involves requirement, like a distribution requirement, that would educate students about the history of injustice.
Okay, thank you, Harold. Last question, and then Risa has a good and welfare presentation, but Peter first here. Peter.
I also commend the students for coming today. Why not broaden the perspective of racism, though, in, for example, given what's going on in the country and politically, the wide economic gaps in the country, why not look at the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? I think if you go through the 10 Bill of Rights, for example, or the 15 Bill of Rights, you can find racism, exhibits of racism in pretty much every one of those. But I would urge the students also to focus tremendously on the First Amendment, that is freedom of speech, which I hold to be the most important amendment that we have. Because in many instances over the last few months that have occurred, things may not be exactly as they seem when they're typed in on the internet. And the Bill of Rights is a crucial way of people expressing their opinion, both conservative and liberal, and is important to hold that incredibly dear. And it is also incredibly important for the topic of racism.
Okay. Uchai, you'd like to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to, I guess, make a really quick point. It's like, you know, yes, I understand that for some people they're maybe partially concerned about, you know, the Bill of Rights and freedom of speech and things of that nature. And like, that's totally understandable. But I think that the larger issue is that, you know, words, you know, they have impact on people. And, you know, what we're looking for is the fact that, you know, we can talk about different examples of, you know, incidents that have happened with, you know, different professors and students on campuses. You know, on this campus, I guess at this university, like, we really have to be careful about, like, how, again, like, how we're interacting with other students that come from different backgrounds, come from marginalized communities, and understanding that, you know, certain things shouldn't be, you know, when we're talking about issues such as race, sex, gender, things of that nature, certain things are, you know, words can oppress people. Words obviously can be very discriminatory. And I really want to make sure that, you know, at an institution where, you know, it's committed to education, higher education, that we're, you know, pushing these students to be, you know, leaders within this country and making sure that we're not, you know, allowing any room for any kind of discrimination or saying terrible things to, like, other students. It's, I can see how it's easy, you know, to probably say that, but, like, you know, me being a Black man, you know, queer man of color, going through, you know, I have a very different experience from, you know, my white counterparts on this campus. And it's very easy for people to say, well, you know, it's my freedom. I have the right of speech to, you know, say X, Y, and Z words. But it's because I, you know, what I've kind of deduced it down to is the fact that people don't live that experience, and you don't know, people don't understand the impact that it has on that person. The things that you say, the things that you do, especially if you're, you know, in a position of power, you know, when we're talking about power dynamics and, you know, the asymmetry of all of it, it's just, I really do feel like we have a responsibility, we have a duty as an institution to work towards, you know, eradicating, you know, any instances of injustice, discrimination, racism, and things of that nature.
Very good. I see Ken has his hand up, and then we'll have to wrap this up. Ken Berman.
Yeah, I want to thank you for that last comment, actually, which I liked very much. And at the same time, I simply want to say that that I believe Peter made an extremely important point, that in our society and in our university, we need freedom of speech. And I don't mean freedom of hate speech. I think Mark Lewis pointed that out on chat. I don't think hate speech should have a place on campus or intentional speech that's harmful should have a place on campus. We've had episodes in recent years, not as much, the ones I've been directly impacted by is we've had episodes of anti-Semitic speech on campus, especially associated with Technion at New York Tech campus and the movement called BDS. And I've been very offended by that. And yet, I've also felt that freedom of speech sometimes involves an obligation to accept a certain degree, a limited degree of things one finds a little bit offensive. So I very much am committed to Black Lives Matter and to making Cornell a better place. And I like the idea of an anti-racist Cornell very much. And I'm glad the students have brought these ideas together to us. But I hope we don't drift in the direction of trying to legislate against free speech. I'd much rather that we tackle this problem of how to welcome free speech while also not welcoming hate speech.
Okay, thank you, Ken. Okay, so I'd like to again echo what a lot of my colleagues have said. Wonderful presentation to the four students, and we really look forward to continuing to work with you on these difficult issues. I think you've taken us to we're at a new level, and that new level is that we have to figure out how to get concrete with proposals and recommendations on all these particular issues. I've talked a little bit with Nima, and we'll talk with others about this. We'd really like to have a plan rolled out within a week or so about how we're gonna go about addressing these issues and really doing something. So again, thank you so much, Do Better Cornell, and we'll be in touch. Risa has a brief good and welfare statement, and then just a reminder that after that, we'll turn off the microphone and we hang around in the hall, whatever, if people still have energy here. So Risa.
Yeah, thank you, Charlie. This good and welfare is actually, you know, apropos issues of shared governance and such. I just want to add just very quickly on the discussion we just started having about speech and academic freedom and where are the lines between academic freedom and, you know, equal access to the classroom and to the campus for everybody. These are issues that deserve much more discussion than we had time to today. We're covering a huge swath of issues, right? Including committees and student representation, et cetera, et cetera. So I hope that we can have deep conversations that are difficult to have because they're worth it and because we have values that we want to promote. So I certainly hope we talk more about this. My specific announcement was that we are having a Cornell chapter of the AAUP meeting in just a few minutes. We thought it would be useful to have it right after the Senate meeting on our agenda. And I'll put in the chat session the link if anybody wants to come to the AAUP meeting. One of the specific things we're going to talk about is the issue of shared governance with regard to reopening the campus and concerns about the lack of shared governance on many of the issues. We have a proposed resolution, so please do come if you're interested. Here's the information about the Zoom link and coming if you'd like. And if you're interested in the AUP separately, please, you know, contact me, and there are other people who will be happy to talk with you about it. That's it, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Risa. Okay, so this is the formal end of the meeting. Jill's gonna turn off the record button.